Alrighty, so I hope you all had a good break for lunch. And I assume, are some people going to the gala dinner tonight? Yeah, some people going for that? Okay, excellent. So, this morning we talked about wisdom, and we mainly looked at the subjective side of wisdom, at what the process of wisdom is like, how we develop it, the different aspects of it, the relationship between more trivial or basic forms of knowledge and then the more profound forms, and the way that through Buddhist practice we lead from the simple and everyday forms of knowledge to the more life-changing forms of knowledge that come with deep insights. But we didn't talk all that much about the content of wisdom, like what are we actually, if we're understanding, what is it that we're understanding? And of course, it should hardly need to be said that wisdom from a Buddhist perspective is not just kind of random wisdom or understanding, but it's wisdom or understanding which is focused in a very clear way. And the Buddha said that just like the leaves in the forest are many, but the handful that I have in my hand are very few, in the same way that the teachings that he knows are very many, but the things that he's actually teaching are very few, which is a little bit like Google, right? Now, if you Google, you get millions of responses, millions of hits, but only a few of them are actually relevant. So this is what is the relevant kind of knowledge? And so from a Buddhist point of view, the relevant knowledge is summed up as the Four Noble Truths: suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path, the way of practice leading to the ending of suffering. So four words: suffering, origination, cessation, path. We can sum up the whole of the Dhamma in those four words. So in the suttas it says that just like every footprint of every animal can fit within the footprint of the elephant. And the same way the footprint, well, I obviously didn't know about brontosauruses, but anyway, leaving aside brontosauruses, the footprint of every animal can fit within the footprint of the elephant. The same way, all of the Dhammas which the Buddha taught can be fit within the Four Noble Truths. So this is a quality which the Dhamma has of extreme compressibility. You can make it as short or as long as you like. Four words: suffering, origin, cessation, path. Everything fits into them. Now, when the Buddha talked about how to develop wisdom, while the Four Noble Truths provides the overall framework, there are many other important teachings which can guide us towards developing wisdom. And it's important to keep all of these things within that context that we talked about this morning. Remember that we talked about starting with the little things, starting with the leaves, the individual facts, the individual phenomena. What is actually presented to you, this thing right here? And we keep on paying attention to that. We keep on watching. We keep on investigating that. And we give that a lot of time and a lot of care and a lot of attention. One of the things which I notice in spiritual life, and which I think is quite widespread, is that people are very often in a rush to make these very sweeping generalizations and so on about things that they don't know anything about. And I look at them and I think, well, what are you talking about? You don't know anything about this. How can you say that, you know? Like if you're doing interfaith dialogue, I do quite a lot of interfaith work, and people will say things like, oh yes, the Buddha and Jesus, they really taught the same thing. And I'm like, but I've been studying the Buddha's teachings for 20 years and I still don't understand it all. Much less the teaching of Jesus. I mean, you can't even understand the teachings of one of these teachers after studying and learning and practicing it for so long. can you possibly say, oh yes, I know that I can understand both of these great masters and spiritual teachers, and I can say not only do I understand both of them, but they're both the same. I find this completely absurd. And yet you find this kind of thing being said again and again and again and again. So when it comes to these knowledge claims, the Buddha always said that we should be very cautious, very conservative, very humble about how we go about that. And I think we touched on some of these things earlier in the earlier workshops. So some of the frameworks which the Buddha gave us to help understand, they're ways of giving us particular perspectives, particular frameworks that we can approach the Dhamma from a certain angle. Of course, the Dhamma is always the same, right? But these give us ways of investigating and seeing things that we might not have noticed before. Okay, so here we have the three characteristics. And as you can see, there's four of them. So impermanence, anicca, dukkha, suffering, not self, anatta, and then emptiness. And actually, this is one where the traditions are a little bit ambiguous in the Pali texts. You usually find it's just the three, the tilakana, three characteristics, in the texts of many of the northern traditions. And you find this is true right from the time of the early text onwards. So from the early Sanskrit text and Chinese text in Chinese translation, often where the Pali just has the three characteristics, the northern traditions, especially the Sarvastivadin tradition, would usually have the four, including emptiness as the fourth. And that's the kind of emphasis on emptiness you see right from the time of the early Buddhist texts through to the much later philosophical traditions. And if you've ever studied Tibetan traditions, they usually talk about the four Dhamma seals. Yeah, so seals are not the kinds of, they're not things that clap their hands and balance balls on their noses in water parks. Seals are, they're like the stamps, right? So this is like characteristics like stamped on everything that there is. If we look, if we read reality, we see these characteristics to it. Actually, in early Buddhism, usually emptiness is pretty much a synonym for not self. So this is one of the ways that we can approach wisdom, and one of the ways which is taught very, very often in the suttas and is a very basic framework for how we go further into the nature of reality, the relationships between things and how they work. Dalia. Well, I would say that's probably why it's not usually added in the Pali texts, because it really doesn't add anything. So it's really just a slightly different way of looking at the same thing. Yeah, that's why. I mean, I think the addition of emptiness is probably a sort of slightly later development, even though it's found in the early texts in some schools. Yeah, I suspect so. Yeah, yeah. It's not quite true to say that emptiness is sometimes used as a synonym in the early text, but it's also used in a slightly, its own slightly idiomatic way. Yeah. Emptiness is, if you look like in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, for example, then emptiness has got its own particular nuance, which is a bit slightly different from the way that not self is usually treated. Yeah, but on the whole, it's a similar kind of idea. Okay, so impermanence. Sorry, Ananda. Sunyata, yeah. Yeah. Sunyata. Shh is in Sanskrit. That's the important thing, is getting the pronunciation right. Sunyata, okay. So, impermanence. Everything's impermanent, right? Who said yes? How do you know that? Okay. That's your experience? Okay, fair enough. So can you see impermanent, can you think, see things changing in this moment? Yeah, of course. Where was that? Sorry. Of course, you can see things changing in this moment. So you feel one sensation and then you feel another one. That's a very good point, yeah. That's a very good point. Can you actually see, because change is something that happens in time, right? Even if it's very short, it still happens over a period of time. Yeah. So is it something that you can actually see? Can you see change? Or do you infer it? Can you see those things at the same time, simultaneously? Hang on. So let's just backtrack a little bit there. We are beings who exist in time. Really? So time is a thing in which we exist. Because we're born mortal, and so if we were born immortal, we wouldn't be bound to those laws? It's conditioned. Okay. Okay, we could go. That's pretty dry and cold and stuff, yeah. Just come back to that basic point about there's lots of dust. If you like red dust, it's actually quite a lot like WA, really. Except colder and probably easier to get to. I'm not sure. Yeah, the locals are friendlier, I think. okay. Come back to that question of change. So we think that we see change, right? But actually what you see one thing and then you see something else. Do you actually see something changing into something else? You can infer that it's changed, yeah? Yeah. Have you seen the change? You've seen, but as you said, one second they're alive, the next second they're dead. You've seen those two things. Have you seen the actual change from one state to the other? That's right. You see the animate and then you see the inanimate. Do you see the animate becoming inanimate? Or is that something you can actually see? It's an inference and sometimes an inconvenient inference. Why is it inconvenient? And then you think to yourself, how could that process happen to her while it hasn't happened to me? Yeah. Yeah, oh, I know, yeah. Okay? Yeah. A constantly visible process. Okay. Yeah. No. That's good. I'm not trying to sort of push one explanation. I'm just trying to sort of problematize this notion of impermanence a little bit, because it's something which often we take for granted and we think is very simple. And so I'm just trying to point out that actually change is not as obvious as we might think. And so these questions about when we observe change, is it something which we actually directly observe, or is it something that we infer? Yeah. Obviously, to a large degree, it is inferred, right? I mean, obviously on a large scale, if you see a person aging, for example, or something like that, then that's obviously inferred. But on that small scale, like when you're watching a tree shift, it's not quite so obvious. And so the boundaries are getting a bit blurry here. And of course, this is one of the things which you see at a much more sharp degree in when your meditation gets sharp and your mind gets very clear, then of course everything slows down and you can see these things, see the processes unfolding more and more clearly. Yeah. The essential point is that even with something as simple as impermanence, right, your mind is involved in that. Right? Your mind is completely involved in interpreting and understanding that experience. Yeah. So what about dukkha? What about suffering?
What about it?
Yeah.
Suffering is something you can watch. You might not have the same effect on you if you've gone through that yourself.
Right. Okay.
So I'm saying there's direct and indirect experience of suffering.
Okay, so you experience somebody else's suffering. Is experiencing someone else's suffering also suffering? Sometimes it's happiness, isn't it? Depends who they are and whether they really deserve it, right? And sometimes seeing other people's happiness is a lot of suffering. Yeah. And the connections made in your mind.
Yeah, so the inference is actually something almost separate from those two things.
Yeah.
You've woven an inference into the idea that the deer has heard this.
Right.
Whereas it's just two separate things.
Right. And that's where you actually respond to a story. That's why you have the show don't tell axiom. Because if you tell the twig snapped and then the deer turned its head, then there's no drama or interest to it. But it's that part that you have to put into it, which is why that creates the drama. Yeah.
I wonder how much of that we do in our own lives in terms of weaving narrative, and how much of that can be undone through what the Buddha suggesting in terms of observing, like you're saying, suffering, what causes suffering, what causes happiness.
Yeah.
Learning to observe the causes and effects of both of those, it's creating more causes and happiness, so it causes more causes and suffering.
Yep, absolutely, yeah. So what is suffering anyway? So other people don't like suffering, do they? They like unsatisfactoriness. Stress.
Mm.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. That's one form of suffering, yeah. To be separated from those things you love, yeah. Okay, so this is just another avenue into that. I mean, obviously we could talk all afternoon about just one of these things. So I'm trying to just give a bit of a survey here. Not self, another one, and not self again. These wisdom teachings are very challenging. I think that's a very good characteristic of Buddhism, and this is why I don't think we should try to water these things down. If somebody here, I remember Bhante Gunaratna told a story once, so he wrote an essay on not self, and he gave it to a friend of his to get some feedback on it. And he gave it to this friend and said, oh, do you mind reading this essay and you know, get back to me and let me know what you think? And then time went by, 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, 2 months, and he didn't hear back from his friend. And so one time he was with him and he just said, oh, by the way, that essay that I gave you, you didn't get a chance to read it, did you? And his friend said, oh, Bhante, look, I'm so sorry, but I opened up that envelope and I looked at the headline and it said not self, and I just got so upset I threw it in the rubbish bin straight away. I couldn't cope with it. So that's a powerful teaching, right? That's a powerful teaching, and that's why we shouldn't try to water these things down or make apologies for them. It is really challenging. Impermanence is really challenging. You're all going to die, right? Suffering is really challenging. Every day that you've got life, you're going to experience suffering. And not self is extremely challenging. Everything that you think that you are, that you own, and that belongs to you, all of this is just delusion. Right? You have no entitlements. There's nothing. Nobody owes you anything. Yeah. And so, if somebody is really freaked out by this, then probably they're not ready for it. So you don't kind of push it on to people if they're not ready. But you don't have to water down the teachings. You just say, okay, never mind, just wait. Yeah. You know, see how things go. And so this teaching on not self is one which I think is sometimes, taught in the wrong context in Buddhism. I think sometimes it's sort of these things are presented as being like introductory teachings or something like that. And but they're really much more profound contemplations, which are meant for people who have a very solid grounding in the Dhamma. They're meant for, you know, in that emergence of wisdom that we've had. We've already had the ethics and your grounding in sila and behavior, and we've had the meditation and the kind of sense of emotional wholeness and peace and still that comes from that. And then from that kind of point of view, you can start to open up to these ideas and to look at them in a much more direct and much more profound way. And then you can see that actually it's not that contemplating not self leads to suffering, right? It's the attachment to the self which leads to suffering. Yeah? It's a mistaken idea of a self which leads to suffering. So when we look at these things in the right way, in the right context, as part of that overall path of Buddhism, they lead to peace. And if they're not leading to peace, then probably it's just a sign that we're not really ready for that part of the teaching yet. Sure. Yeah. You don't hold on to things. Right.
So it seems like when you get involved with tidings, it talks about not self. You're talking about a self who exists, who doesn't exist, which makes you talk about whether you are or are not right now.
Right.
So it seems like you're inappropriate attention in one way.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So you. It's about understanding the process by which you attach to things and identify with them. Yeah. Yeah. The difference between not self and interdependence. Well, not self. In such a hurry to divide them up like that. Actually, there's quite a lot of suttas where they're treated very closely related. And one of the basic philosophical issues is that if you have a self, then how can you have a self that's dependent? Right? So this is the idea of a self has somehow inside it has this kind of notion of autonomy, right? That's basically what a self means. It has autonomy, and if it's autonomous, then how could it be dependent on anything? So the very fact that things that you're dependent on, and that your choices are dependent on your feelings, and that's dependent on your contact, and that's dependent on your experiences, and so on. Yeah, and this is why we know that. Try to explain this in terms of a self, in terms of an independent, autonomous agent, it's just not a very useful way of understanding what's going on. That's right. You heard it from me. The essence of the Buddha's teachings. There's no hope for happiness in life. Yes, yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Yeah, I'm not quite sure why that is. I think that you know you could frame it in different ways, but I guess the point is that when we talk in terms of dukkha, is the most urgent thing. That's what actually drives us to the spiritual quest is the fact that we're suffering, and the other things are ways of reflecting on that and deepening our understanding of it. But the basic thing, the basic reason, motivator for action is feeling, right? Searching for pleasant feeling, wanting to escape from suffering. So this, I think, is when he's talking about putting suffering at center stage, I think this is the reason why. Yeah. Everything's marketing. Right. Absolutely, yeah. I think so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, which is why you just don't get it if you haven't suffered enough. Mm. Sure. Yeah. Okay. Moving on. So some of the other. Okay, we've been talking for a little while now. Let's do some meditation for the next 10 minutes. The next of the wisdom frameworks we're going to look at is the five aggregates. So hopefully all of you have heard of the form, rupa, feeling, vedana, perception, sanya, activity, sankhara, consciousness, vijnana. Remember that the English words we're using are just translations, don't get too hung up on them. None of them quite means what you might think normally in English, but anyway, we try to do our best. And what the five aggregates are, I think, at their most basic, is that they are a scheme for classifying theories of a self. Okay, now if you look in the Buddha's time and you look at different people and how they think about the idea of a self, then they'll tend to say things like myself has form, right? So they'll identify with the physical or material self. And that's what you find people still do today. Yeah? People sort of get very hung up on their body and so on, and they have to be very sort of conscious of that, and so they're thinking of their form as being their self. Or another one, very common kind of self theory today is the idea that I am my DNA. Yeah, and I'm going to live eternally because I'm going to pass down my DNA to my children. So this is another kind of attachment to some physical thing. Feeling, perception. Okay, so feeling often people like to think I'm going to go to heaven and be happy after I die. Yeah. So you get attached to your feeling as yourself. Perception, sankhara, and consciousness, all of these are similar in their own way. So perception essentially is the process by which we create meaningful unities out of the diversity of experience. So through perception is like using naming and concepts, ideas and memory and so on. We filter experience and we create our own reality, which has a meaning and makes sense to us. And so this is what we're doing when we're talking about the idea of perception. So I remember when I was in Malaysia many years ago, they had a very nice billboard, and the billboard had a big photo of a great white pointer shark, and it said, perception, man-eater, reality, eaten by man. Yeah? So to me that's a great example, it's exactly what we mean by perception. Yeah, it's the ideas that you build up in your mind, which, of course, never correspond exactly with the reality. But perception's always useful, right? I mean, you have to have perceptions. Even if you think about that particular one, the great white pointer, perception is man-eater. Well, why do we have this perception? Well, you can easily explain that in terms of evolutionary terms, can't you? Right? We have to have a perception. If you have a perception that animals are dangerous and they're going to eat you, then when you hear a sound, you're going to run away. Now, maybe 100 times the animal actually isn't dangerous and isn't going to eat you. But the 101st time, it is, right? And so if you don't run away, then, you don't leave your genes down in the gene pool, and that perception doesn't become part of the human heritage. So perceptions actually have their use. But the problem is, of course, we get trapped in them. We believe them. And so sometimes they can become dysfunctional and even harmful. Sankhara, activities, basically means volition. Okay, so sankhara, in the case of the five aggregates, essentially means volition or will or intention. It's a bit of a funny word, and we translate it these days. I like to translate it as activities. It's a very literal translation, and it doesn't particularly fit. It's one of these things that neither particularly fits or unfits in any particular context. It fits equally ill just about anywhere it is. So at least it's uniformly poor as a rendering, rather than misleadingly meaning one thing in one place and another thing in another place. Anyway, activity. So we think of it as will or choice or intention. And again, this is something that we often identify with, isn't it? Yeah. So this is my choice. I am the decider. Right? Yeah. Yeah, I'm the one who decides. Yes, Tanya. Not in this context. Of course, yeah. Yeah, in this context it means intention. That's right, yeah. Okay. And consciousness is vijnana, And consciousness is a bit of another problematic translation. It doesn't really mean what we mean by consciousness in English, in pretty much any context. But it basically means awareness of something. Okay? So awareness of sights, or awareness of sounds, awareness of thoughts, awareness of memories, and so on and so forth, is consciousness, or vijnana. So this is one of the great overarching frameworks that's offered in early Buddhism for analysing and understanding what's happening in our experience, and for helping to deepen our wisdom. Again, each one of these frameworks, I could go into a lot of detail to talk about them, but at the moment we're just giving a sort of very general survey to get some idea of what kinds of things that we're talking about. So the point of offering a framework like this is to help us to get a handle on what our experience is like. It's not easy to reflect and inquire and investigate. Yeah? And it's often very useful to give ourselves some kind of framework which is going to limit that inquiry and direct it in a particular direction. And if you've ever done any science, for example, or any research, then you know that exactly the same thing happens, right? If you want to do effective research, the first thing you have to do is to limit the parameters of your research. Yeah? You have to bite it off in manageable chunks. And so when we sit down to meditate, and we sit down to investigate who we are and what's happening, sometimes the complexity of it can be overwhelming. Yeah? There's so many things happening, swirling around in the mind. And it's very hard sometimes to have even, why am I doing these things? What's going on? Where are my thoughts coming from? Why do I make these choices? Why do I feel these things? And it's very hard for us to be able to get a handle on these. So if we can use this method of analysis, we can sit down there in a meditation and we can pick up each of these things in turn. Right? If you know these categories very well, then you can just investigate them each in turn. You say, well, where is form? What is my experience right now of matter, of the physical? You can feel your body when you're sitting in meditation. You can see sights. You can hear sounds. Yeah? So all of these things are part of that rupa. And again, we're following that same idea that I mentioned right from the beginning, is that when you begin, you pay attention to the things in themselves, to the simple experiences. All right? What is it like to touch something? What is it like to hear something? Yeah? These are all part of rupa. And you can see they all have something about them which has some relationship or some similarity. Yeah? And one of the things that you notice about those things is that you usually have some kind of response to it. Right? You usually have a feeling. If you have a sensation, if you hear something, you usually either like it or dislike it. And sometimes you don't care about it. So this response to it, and this is where the Vedana comes in. Yeah? You hear a pleasant sound, your mind's interested in it, you go towards it, you hear an unpleasant sound, your mind moves, so it goes away from it. And so again, this is giving you a framework for investigating your experience in a meaningful way. That's why it's very important to learn these teachings extremely well. Right? Learn them in detail. You should know what all of these things are. You should be able to recite them by memory without even thinking about it. And you should also know, be able to reflect on what the meaning of these things are. So that when the time comes to meditate, yeah, you don't have to think about it. Right? When the time comes to meditate, your mind should automatically go, oh, okay, what's happening? And then you see things in terms of that framework. Ah, okay, that's how my mind's making sense of this. Yeah. Ah, I heard that tweety sound and my mind said bird, and this is perception, yeah? This is perception that's putting that sound together with my memory and creating a new reality for it. And so you investigate and you understand that process as it's unfolding. Alright? Next one, also very important, a very interesting one, the six senses. Again, I won't go into this in too much detail, but just to that eye and forms, ear and sounds, the nose and smells, the tongue and tastes, body and touch, mind with mental objects and processes. thoughts and feelings and imaginings and memories and plannings and intentions and just about anything else that's going on in your mind. Yeah? Perceptions, yep. Yeah. Anything that's happening in your mind that you are aware of. Yeah, so one of the points about this is again to help us to understand our mind better, because when you investigate each of these senses, right, you see the duality of these senses quite easily, right? You see that, well, there's an eye in here which is aware of the sights out of there, and we're able to distinguish between those things quite readily, right? There's no great mystery there. And similarly, there's an ear in here, and that hears sounds coming from outside. So you investigate that and you see, but the more you go into it, the more you see, it doesn't just happen to be the case that things work that way, right? That's the structure of experience, yeah? That's how consciousness works, that there's an awareness of something, right? And so by the time we work our way around to investigating the mind and the dhammas or the mental processes, right, then we're already primed, if you like, to see it in that same way. That just as the eye is in here and sees sights out there, in the same way we have our mind and the awareness, which somehow feels more inner. And it's aware of things which somehow feel more external to us. Things like thoughts and imaginings and all those things we just mentioned. You reflect on that right now as you're sitting there. You reflect that there's a knowing. And we usually experience that knowing as being something which is really at our core, at the heart of who we are. And that knowing is aware of those other things, the other thoughts. In the suttas, it calls it bahidha janama rupa, external name and form. In that case, it doesn't mean outside yourself, but it's just that subjective sense that there's an inner core with that external phenomena which present themselves. So this is another way of investigating the mind. And what it does is it helps us to realize that sense of being somehow a unique, eternal self inside here, this also is conditioned. Yeah? Just as the eye consciousness is conditioned, the ear consciousness is conditioned. And so we break down this idea that consciousness or the mind consciousness is an uninterrupted continuum. It's something which, like any other form of consciousness, is just a function. It's just something that we do. We perform that act of knowing. Sort of. Yeah. So what's the implication? No, not state. It's a function. It's a behavior. Yeah. So it's something that you do. Yeah. You are conscious of something. Yeah. And so because it's an energetic process, yeah, it takes its own fuel, its own food, right? Yeah, it needs to be sustained by something. It's not just self-sustaining. And because it latches on and it's dependent on that food, then it's that dependence which drives it from right consciousness from lifetime to one lifetime to the other. Yeah, but we don't think of consciousness as being something which, if you like, you have to be careful of your language. Like, you can talk loosely about these things, but it's not really helpful to talk about consciousness as underpinning rebirth or as carrying you from one life to the other or something like that. Yeah. Again, consciousness is a behavior. Think of it as a behavior. And if you know, imagine how hard it is to stop your behaviours, right? Yeah, imagine if you're an actor and you have to sort of go into a play and completely be somebody else, and all of the little, the ways you hold your body and all the little tics and things and so on that you do, you don't do them, you do another person's. Yeah. So these things are actually extremely ingrained. And the same thing with our consciousness, how we are aware, the manner of our awareness is even more deeply and more subtly ingrained. It's sort of inscribed with these personal characteristics. That's why each person here has a consciousness, right? Yeah, you all have an awareness. Maybe somewhat contracted after lunchtime, but in any case, it's still there. And this is why I normally give Ramali the after lunchtime session. Hang on. So even though that awareness is in each person is changing, right? But each person has their own signature, their own manner of awareness or consciousness, which is what distinguishes one person from another. Eh? Just as we all have a behaviour, but we have different behaviours. Okay. So when we talk about consciousness as being that which underpins rebirth, that's really a unfortunate way of describing it. It's a better way of thinking of it that there are these conscious processes, these conscious behaviours, patterns, if you like, patterns of energy, yeah, which play themselves out in transformed contexts or forms. Yeah. But even though they're transformed, they're still recognisably a similar pattern of energy. Think, for example, like a song. Yeah, and you can think of a song that's been covered and played by so many different people. Yeah, it doesn't just exist as one thing. Everybody sings it slightly differently. Sometimes it's, you know, live played by musicians. Sometimes it's something that's running through your head. Sometimes it's something you listen to on your MP3 player. Yeah? Each time you listen to it, it's something different. But still, it's similar enough that you can call it the same song because there's some patterns to it which are recognisably similar. Yeah. So, Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. That aspect of repetition is really important to that, yeah, in conditioning. Yeah. Readiness potential? I have no idea what you mean by ready. Not, no. Right? Okay. And that's going to determine their level of empathy is with them. So is it just a job or not is it just a job? So this thing that's doesn't seem to be going that's way deeper than words, is that something that's ticking over in the is it a part of the mind of it, body of it? It's sort of a lot of Yeah, it's a sort of conditioning, Seems I'm not quite familiar with it, but it seems like a kind of an aspect maybe of perception or something like that. And perception's like shaping the way that you see things, yeah, the manner in which you see them. I know there was a study done a little while ago on judges who are hearing court cases and so on, and you know you could see like the percentage of verdicts that they gave at different times in the day, right? Yeah, so the more tired and frazzled they are, the harsher the verdict became. So, so this perception, like how you choose to see things. Yeah. It would be part of how the mind works, yeah. Dania. Well, it's whatever occurs in the mind that's left over. I mean, all of them are forms of consciousness. That's correct. Yeah. So in a sense, they all happen in your mind. Yeah. But the ones that are not directly dependent on all of those others are what we call the mind objects. It is. Yeah. It is. You can't have an eye consciousness without an eye. Is eye consciousness, maybe that's the one that's patented by Mac, is it? By Apple? I'm not sure. But anyway, moving along. Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. You know, you're aware of sights and sounds and smells and tastes and so on, and that's a different kind of thing than it is aware of just mental objects. And even though, yes, of course they are related, and part of the deeper process of wisdom is of course to understand precisely that point. But in order to understand it, you have to come as close as you can to the raw experience. Now, whether you can ever come to an unfiltered raw experience or not, okay? Well, that's one of the things that we're going to find out. Yeah? And again, you think about it from a scientific point of view. Say, from a scientific point of view, you might say, well, I want to gather data objectively. Right? But of course, there's no such thing. Okay? We're always subjective, and we're always fueled by different kinds of, you know, wishes and biases and so on. But at least you try. You come as close as you can to an idea, an objective sense of data. And so it's the same thing with these processes. You come as close as you can. What is it like to experience seeing before any of that other stuff happens? Yeah? And then you can gradually start to see how the process works. Yeah. But it is a good point that we shouldn't reify these concepts, and it's not that the experience is built out of these pure ideas which we then have to combine into one. In fact, it's the opposite, and it's a very important point for understanding the Buddha's teachings. Experience is a mess. Yes, experience is a mess, right? That's what we're presented with. That's our problem. We can't make sense of it because it's a mess. And so we get these frameworks, and they help us to clean up the mess, and they help us to make sense of it, right? But it's not that experience comes naturally divided and categorized into all of these things. All right. Another one. The fields of wisdom. Elements: earth, water, fire, air. And then sometimes we add space and consciousness to that. This is another one where we see a little bit of a difference between the Pali Suttas, the early Buddhist Pali Suttas, and the Sarvastivadin and other Sanskrit Suttas. They almost always include the six elements, whereas in the Pali text we usually have the four and occasionally five with the addition of space, and occasionally six, but usually just the four elements. Earth, water, fire, and air. So obviously these aren't elements in the sense of kind of modern chemical elements, but they're actually quite similar to the basic properties of matter, aren't they? Yeah, that we learnt in high school. Yeah, solid, liquid, gas, and heat is the element of change. Right, so heat is what moves one from for example, water goes from solid to liquid to gas because of the application of heat. So it's actually quite when you kind of look at that, it's actually quite an extraordinarily modern and rational system of understanding the elements, understanding the physical world. And this is a bit beside the point, but if you have a sort of look around and the ancient world, there's a lot of different systems of elements and things, but most of them are not as systematic and rational as this one. So this particular kind of contemplation is perhaps one which is not done so much these days, but it is emphasized quite a lot in the early Buddhist texts, and it's some of the most powerful of the suttas, the Mahāhatipadopama Sutta on the greatest simile of the elephant's footprint, and the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, among others, very profound and very, very powerful discourses on the contemplation of the elements. And like so many of the other contemplations in the Dhamma, we start with what's obvious and move to what's subtle. Okay? So what's obvious? Earth. Right? You can stamp on it. You can kick it. It's right there. You fall over and you hit it. Right? In a more more abstract sense, the earth is the quality of hardness. Okay, so earth has the quality of resistance. So when you're doing the meditation on that, you can see, you can discern that quality of resistance or stiffness or hardness. You can observe that in external things. Right? You can feel this table, and you can observe it inside your own body. You can feel your bones. You can feel the sense of resistance in your muscles, especially if your muscles are tight or something like that. And so you can investigate and see in your body that earth element. And if you're doing that as a meditation, then you begin with just one part of your body. You begin with your arm or your hand or your head or whatever it is. And just say, well, where is the earth element? Where do I feel that quality of hardness and resistance? And you, again, that idea that you focus to begin with on the direct experience, what is actually present in your consciousness. And start with that. Okay. And then you follow that through, okay. And then you go to water and you contemplate. Again, you start with the most obvious examples of water. Usually if you're sitting in meditation, the most obvious example of water is probably the saliva in your mouth. Yeah, so you just aware, okay, there's a wetness there. And then you move and investigate through different parts of your body and see that. And always in the way it's presented in the early Buddhist texts, you contemplate the elements internally and externally. Yeah? So you see that the earth element inside my body and the earth element outside is just earth element. Okay? Again, the same as in modern science or chemistry or whatever, you know that there's no special different thing that our body's made up of. It's just carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen and a few bits of other things. The same as things, stuff around us. Yeah. So this is, again, a way of breaking down this sense of uniqueness, this sense that we're somehow special or anything like that. It's just the elements, and so we don't get attached to it. And just as this body was formed out of the elements, it will go back to them. Now, when space is introduced to this is a very interesting way, because you contemplate each of these elements as being something which is present, right? You can actually feel them, you can experience them directly, but then space, there's nothing there, right? So space is the absence. And there's actually a long and rich philosophical tradition in Buddhism of arguing whether space is real or not. Yeah? It's one of the classic Abhidhamma disputes. Is space something that really exists or not? And it might sound like a kind of silly question, but this, of course, was one of the crucial problems in modern physics as well. And you'll probably know from the 19th century, the problem of the ether. And they said, well, you know, waves have to propagate in a medium. So if light and electromagnetism are waves, then they must have a medium in which they propagate. And so they said this medium is the ether. Where is it? What properties does it have? What kind of thing is it? And they kept on looking and looking for the ether, and they realized it didn't exist. There's no such thing. So that idea of whether space is something which exists or space is something which is merely the absence of everything else. This is something which is or at least was for a while anyway, a vital issue in modern science. From the point of view of the early Buddhist texts, space does not exist. Right? The early Buddhist texts treat space always as being something which is conditioned by the other elements. Yeah? So you can only know space in the gap between the other elements. So this is something which comes at a deeper and a more subtle level in the contemplation. So as you contemplate, you look at these different elements, you see the relationships between them. And the funny thing that happens in meditation is that as you go deeper and you see these things more clearly and you focus in on them more clearly, the more closely you see them, the more they disappear. Yeah? It's very funny. And again, I can't help on noticing the parallels between this and science. You know, you think of this as a table, and the more you look in there, the more you realize it's just atoms and it's just energies, and there's nothing to it. And that idea of solidity is an illusion that happens at quite a high level scale, but at a very close level, there's just energies moving, patterns of energies moving. And if we look even at those patterns of energies moving, we look even closer into that, you can't see anything at all. Yeah? And so you leave all of those things behind, and then that contemplation of space emerges. Yeah? So it's a very subtle kind of contemplation, which happens as a natural part of that process of meditation. Yeah? And because that process of awareness of space is very subtle, your awareness of space is awareness of the most subtle kind of physical object, if you like. It's not even an object, it's just an absence. And so because you're aware of nothing much at all, then it's natural that the reflection will come back to, well, what is being aware? What is that process of being aware? And so then the consciousness comes as the last of those elements. Yeah. Well, I'm talking about something like that. Yeah. I mean, that's the most profound level of realizing that process. Yeah. Okay, so. Hot topic, like, is it trending on Twitter or something? Universal consciousness. What do you want me to say about universal consciousness? I didn't quite get that second last sentence you said, that what you're doing is you're moving in a field. Okay, so there's like a field of consciousness that we're all participating in. Okay. Of course not, yeah. I mean, reason I kind of pricked up my ears when you mentioned that sentence is that seems to me to be something which is I think an interesting idea, which is not necessarily, I mean, it's not necessarily tied to the metaphysical idea of a universal consciousness. It's more like the idea of a field of energy, which I think even on a purely physical level, that could be understood. Yeah, I mean, say gravity and things like that, there's fields, they're interpenetrating and affecting each other all the time. So that idea of a field of consciousness, which where your own consciousness is constantly interacting with others, I think that's actually a very something very true about that. And I think that consciousness is probably more participatory than we imagine it is. It's more relational than we imagine it is. Yeah. But that, which is not entirely, it's not identical with that idea of the universal consciousness as such, yeah. So if you want me to talk about universal consciousness, okay. Right, here we go. So when we talk about consciousness, we talk about vijnana. Okay, so this is the normal word that's used in Pali to mean vijnana. And word vijnana is often explained as being vi, meaning separate. Yeah, so we is related to the word for two, and one of the meanings that it has sometimes is to separate. And jnana is knowledge. So vijnana is sense separative consciousness. And we find this term used in the explanations of this by some teachers who probably shall remain unnamed. And so then they go on to argue, one of the arguments you hear is that vijnana, separative consciousness, is what the Buddha was treating under the five aggregates, and then when that's left behind, you then have this unified or universal or cosmic consciousness, or sometimes the original mind, which is what's left behind when that separative consciousness is got rid of or whatever, or transcended. But one of the problems with that is that vijnana, if we look at how what it means in context, means precisely does not mean separative consciousness. What the V in vijnana means, and is actually explained in the Hindu commentaries as meaning infinite. V means infinite, right? And that's the explanation that's given to this word in the Hindu Upanishads. And of course, that's precisely the meaning that it often has in Buddhism, where you have obviously the base of infinite consciousness and so on and so forth. So vijnana does not mean in itself, it doesn't mean separative consciousness. The basic meaning of it is some kind of infinite or universal consciousness. And this is the idea which was developed and evolved in the Upanishads, which were especially in the teachings of a sage called Yajnavalkya. And Yajnavalkya was a wonderful teacher whose dialogues are, I think, some of the most profound and most interesting in the pre-Buddhist world. And they're found in a work called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So just when you thought that you'd had enough of hearing about the Digha Nikaya and the Majjhima Nikaya and all these Buddhist texts, now I'm talking about all these Hindu ones as well. Anyway, bad luck. You're going to have to deal with it. So in the Upanishads, so this is the context that the Buddha was talking in. These are the people who he was talking to. We always have to remember this when you're understanding Buddhism. The people that the Buddha was talking to had never heard of Abhidhamma, they'd never heard of Buddhaghosa, they'd never heard of Mahayana or Theravada or any of these things. They'd certainly never heard of Jack Kornfield or Ajahn Brahm or Bhandesiddhata, right? Or psychology or neuroscience or anything like that. What they had heard of was the Upanishads, right? And the teachings and the ideas which were current in those. The Upanishads are the highest and most beautiful philosophy which had been developed in India prior to the time of the Buddha. And well worth a read, especially the first, the oldest of the Upanishads. The most important one is called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. The Brihad you translate as the magnificent forest secret teachings, something like that. And Brihadaranyaka Upanishad has a lot of very interesting dialogues and discussions and so on. But the most important, and it's not like Upanishads are not like a unified teaching like the Buddhist suttas are. It's not like the teaching of one person. It's a gathering of the wisdom sayings and teachings and so on of the kind of Brahmanical culture from that era. And there's a loose theme to it, but it's by no means really unified. But of the many teachers who are represented in that collection, the most important one is one called Yajnavalkya. And the main theme of Yajnavalkya's teachings is this idea of the self and the Atman is what he's coming to. Now, the idea of the Atman had been through a long process already by this time. It had been understood, interpreted, explained in many different ways by different teachers. And Yajnavalkya was the first one to really come to this idea of the Atman, the self, as being awareness, as being pure consciousness. And he explained this in the first time that I'm aware of anywhere in the world, where he really talked about this very clearly. He kept on pointing to this mysterious subject. He used this phrase, the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. Yeah, that is yourself. Yeah. And in one of his dialogues, the interesting things about Yajnavalkya, he has two of his two most important dialogues are both with women. Yeah? Again, this is very interesting from a historical point of view, because it's often said in the later Brahmanical tradition, it says that women aren't allowed to be taught the higher teachings and so on and so forth. But here in the universally regarded as the two greatest dialogues in all the Upanishads, in fact, discussions between Yajnavalkya and women. In one case, his wife, Maitreya, and on the other occasion, a female Brahmani philosopher called Gargi. And in both cases, the overall theme of the dialogue is the idea of the self. In the discussion with Maitreya, he says goes through this whole kind of list of things. It's not for the sake of the wife that the wife is dear, but for the sake of the self. It's not for the sake of the husband that the husband is dear, but for the sake of the self. It's not for the sake of the children that the children are dear, but for the sake of the self. It's not for the sake of the cows or the wealth or the land or the nation, and it goes through all of these things. None of these things are really the important thing. The only thing that's important is the self, yeah, the Atman. And then he talks about the Atman in this way. He uses this word ekayana, which we're very familiar in Buddhism from the Satipatthana Sutta, the ekayana magga, the one-way path, the way to convergence. And the ekayana means the place where everything comes together as one. All sights come together as one in the eye. All sounds come together as one in the ear. All thoughts come together as one in the mind. And again, he goes on and on and on, listing all of these things. That everything's coming together. Where is that place? Yeah, that place in the core, in the heart, where everything comes together. Yeah? And of course, this is the Atman. And then when he describes that Atman, he says this Atman is a vijnana ghanameva, a sheer mass of consciousness, or vijnana. Yeah? And he was the first teacher, first philosopher, to very explicitly point to this kind of pure, eternal knowing consciousness as being the core of identity, being the Atman, vijnanam Atman. Yeah? So when and many, many similes and ideas which support this and illustrate this kind of theory. So it's specifically these ideas which the Buddha was responding to and quite clearly and explicitly refuting when he came to give his teachings. And his use of the word vijnana and nama rupa and many other terms which are taken from the Brahmanical context clearly shows that he's lifting, using the philosophical language from his time, right, and accepting some aspects of it and critiquing others and so on and so forth. But if you look closely at the language, how he's using it, specifically how he uses this language when he's in discussions with Brahmins, who are talking about their own particular doctrines. I'm thinking of texts like, say, the Sola Sapanha in the Parayanavagga, where the 16 Brahmins come and they're discussing and they ask about these things, vijnana and nama rupa and so on and so forth. And so you can see that the Buddha's quite explicitly talking about the ending of these things. And we can see that there's even like direct phrases where this is brought out. I'm just trying to think of one. How does it go now? From the Sola Sapanha, it's I used to know it very well. My brain's obviously getting older. I need some more coffee. one or the other. But the effect of it is talking about where what happens when Nama Rupa ends. Yeah, and in the suttas, in the Parayana Vagga, the Buddha is talking to a Brahmin. He says, "What happens when Nama Rupa ends?" And he says that it's like a flame which has gone out. Atiyata vatavege na kitang, when like a flame which is thrown, tossed by a strong wind. Namakaya vimutto, and then one is completely freed, and then it goes out, it comes to an end. Atangatasa napamana mati. There's no measure, there's no way of knowing one who's come to an end. And so this is the phrasing which you find in the suttas. But what's interesting is that particular verse has an almost exact correlate in one of the Upanishads, almost same wording that's used in a couple of the lines. And in there, the last line, instead of saying gone out like a flame, it says paraparang purishang divyang, I think is what it says. Beyond the beyond is that divine person. Yeah, when Nama Rupa ends, that pugala, yeah, that divine person that you enter into that divine person who's beyond the beyond. So you can see this very clear distinction between this idea of that sort of a postulated metaphysical entity, yeah, which is awareness or consciousness or that divine person or whatever it is. And then the Buddha was always talking about emptiness and letting go and coming to an end. So I think as soon as we start talking about this idea of universal consciousness, we're starting to bring in these Upanishadic ideas back into Buddhism. There's a long history of that. Yeah, it's not a new thing. We can trace it many times happening in ancient India itself. And the ancient Indian philosophers would make that same critique, yeah, that they were sneaking Hindu ideas in the back door. Yeah. Interestingly enough, when I was in Taiwan a few years ago, I was asked the same question by a Taiwanese nun. And she was saying that this is like a really hot topic in Taiwanese Buddhism now. Yeah. And so again, they have a similar kind of interpretive problem. And one of the interesting shifts that they've seen is that traditionally in Taiwanese and Chinese Buddhism, that they tended to emphasize this original mind kind of idea, which comes ultimately from a Yogacara philosophy. But in more recent times, that was challenged by Master Yinshun. And Yinshun argued that the idea of that, of the alaya vijnana, or the storehouse consciousness, or that original mind idea, he said that that was used as a skillful means of teaching in a way that could bring Hindus into the Buddhist fold, but is not really an expression of the highest Buddhist teaching. And he understood that in terms of emptiness. So it is interesting to see how the same discussions are framed slightly different ways, but throughout the Buddhist world in different contexts. Yeah. The one, the original mind, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is. It is very common. I'm not that familiar with it, so I can't say how widespread it is. But it's interesting that you can trace it in ancient India. Like, it has its own evolution. These ideas have their own evolution. It's certainly not universal or taken for granted within, say, Mahayana sutras and treaties from India. What actually you find is this Vasubandhu I mentioned a bit earlier belonged to a school called the Yogacara, and in the Tibetan tradition they always called Yogacara the mind-only school, yeah, Chittamatta, yeah. And even that term can, in itself, reveals an interesting shift in how these things can play out, right? Chittamatta, mind only, is how it's translated, mind only. If you look back at what Vasubandhu was actually saying, right, the phrase that he actually used was vijñapti matra. It was not chitta matra, it was vijñapti matra. Vijñapti is a causative form from vijnana. It means making of consciousness. Okay? So what it means, and matra doesn't mean only, right? And they translate it as mind only, but this is actually a misunderstanding. Sometimes it means only, but usually it means mere. Yeah? So what Vasubandhu was pointing, what was mere makings of consciousness. Okay? In other words, he was saying this world that we live in is being produced by our consciousness. Essentially, he was saying, Manopubangama Dhamma. Yeah? Mind is the forerunner of all things. Yeah? That we live in this world which is being created. The mind is this formative force which is creating the world that we're living in. And yet somehow that gets gradually, little bit by little bit, changed until he was saying that everything is just the mind and we're living in this world which is just the mind. But that's not really what Vasubandhu was trying to say. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, look, tell me about it. Yeah, it's astonishing. Yeah. And well, in the recent months, I've been working on this sort of central site and working on the Buddha suttas and scriptures and so on. You see these things happening so many times. And these ideas and the way that it's put and so many astonishing things that you find there. It's just incomprehensible. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Danya. Paramang sukhang. I'm working with Dania to get more articulate questions happening. Okay. Number one, is it authentic? I don't see why not, but I haven't particularly studied that particular passage, so I can't say. Well, sometimes also the teachings are always contextual, yeah? So we can always understand it was said to a certain person at a certain time, right? And so one thing that you can find, and I think is quite common within Buddhism, that people can get on this kind of nihilistic bent, yeah? Especially if you go too deeply into some of these teachings like not-self and dukkha and so on, when you're not really ready for it, then you can get depressed. Yeah? And so when you hear that, you need to hear something a bit hopeful. Nibbana is the best happiness. Yeah? Marketing, it's all marketing. Yeah. Well, I used to get the time for alms round wrong. Which I find that very reassuring, yeah, because I get the time for lots of things wrong. I think, it's just like the Buddha. No, he didn't say that. You're completely missing the point. The point of that whole thing was setting up for some of the greatest humour in sacred literature which there has ever been. And the greatest examples of morbid death humour that you ever find. The Buddha comes out from his retreat and says to Ananda, "The Sangha looks strangely depleted, Ananda." All the monks have been murdering each other. "Sangha looks strangely depleted." Ananda says to him, "It would be good, Bande, if the Blessed One would teach a different kind of meditation." Well, he taught the meditation on the repulsiveness of the body. So then they're all gone and sent each other, "This body is nothing but a nest of suffering," and so on. And then there was this, obviously, a psychopath or something living among the monks, and he said, "Let me help you, send you over to the further shore." And so he's going around killing them, and there's like dozens lying in heaps, and all the monks gone. So? I don't know, that's what it says. I'm just telling you the story. Yes, strangely depleted, yeah. Right. If I have to say personally, you know, I think on an ultimate level, I think that's really something you could only really know from experience. I think you'd go and practice it and see what the result is.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there was discussion. It was definitely seen as being, you know, this is, I'm contradicting your view. I think your view is wrong, and that view of, you know, the vijnana as the Atman is incorrect because the consciousness is conditioned. And, you know, that's stated many times in many different ways, and I think that's the teachings like dependent origination and other kinds of things really pointing to that. But what's also interesting, though, is that even though there's a contradiction, but it's almost as if another way of looking at it is that the Buddha's approach is like an evolutionary step beyond that of Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya's characteristic teaching was a teaching by negation, and his most famous phrase is neti, neti. Yeah? If you ask in the Hindu tradition, what did Yajnavalkya say? Neti, neti, not that, not that. Yeah. And so he was always saying, this isn't the self, this isn't the self, this isn't... Of course, there is a self which lies at the heart of everything, but you can only get there by letting go of all of those other things. Yeah? So actually, you can see the Buddha's approach is actually having a lot of inspiration from that thing. In the Hindu tradition, generally, I think that they say that there's two ways of approaching the Brahman. One is by the path of affirmation, and the other is by the path of negation. And so Yajnavalkya was very much on that path of negation. Neti, neti. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's where they're quoting. When they say that, they're quoting from Yajnavalkya. Yeah. You could do, although the core is more sara, and it's used in itself in a literal sense as like a description of not-self, right? So you can say asara has a similar meaning, but the problem is that the word atman or atta is used in a lot of ways which are actually very similar to how we use the word self in the English language. Yeah, so I did this myself, and so on. And so you find Atman is used in that way, whereas you'd never use the word core in those kind of contexts. So in a sense, you're divorcing yourself from ordinary language usage if you use something like core. Yeah. Yep. Directly, yes, it refers to the self. Yeah. And then the essence is more like the philosophical interpretation or reflection on it. Yeah. But the literal meaning of it is the idea of a self. Yeah. It's only used in psychological context. It's never used, or metaphysical context. It's never used. It doesn't have any other more literal meaning. Yeah. Right. Yep. Yep. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I think that E=mc². It's definitely in line with the whole kind of Buddhist idea on in many different ways, which I think is quite interesting. The whole form is emptiness is form thing is really kind of kind of overblown a bit from its context. But if you look at how, especially in the Sanskrit text of the Heart Sutra, it begins with Avalokiteshvara looking down and contemplating that all of the five khandhas are swabhava shunya, so they're empty of inherent existence. Yeah, and so this is what he was meaning when he's talking about that. But when in the Chinese translation of that, unfortunately, it omits for some reason the term swabhava. So it just says the five khandhas are empty. They're all gone. It doesn't say that they're empty of inherent existence. So this is really a sort of critique of this Abhidhamma idea that these things exist inherently. They each have their own sort of autonomous, self-sustaining existence. Right? And that the Heart Sutra is really just going through the main topics of the Samyutta Nikaya, or the main topics of the Abhidhamma, the five khandhas, the six senses, dependent origination, the Eightfold Path, and so on, and just contemplating each of those in terms of emptiness. Yeah. Right, yeah. Which are all ideas we do find in the suttas. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to touch briefly on dependent origination. In this kind of survey of wisdom teachings from early Buddhist texts. The dependent origination in some ways being the most characteristic and the most interesting of the Buddha's wisdom teachings, and one which probably encompasses all the others or informs all the others. The essence of dependent origination is to observe patterns of relationships. So, yeah. Well, if my slideshow skills were better, I could have made a holograph for you, but they're not, so I just made a list. Thank you very much. So the basic idea underlying dependent origination is we observe patterns of relationships. Okay, I'm not talking about boyfriend-girlfriend relationships. I'm talking about relationships between things like consciousness, feeling, craving, and all of those kinds of things. And you're happening in your own mind, happening outside, and so on. And the Buddha gave a general principle to describe this, and called idapachayata. This being, that is. Right? Imasmin sati idam hoti. This arising, that arises. Imasupada idam upajati. This not being, that is not. Imasming asati idang nahoti. For those of you who are Pali students, this is an example of the locative absolute. You can write that down. Imasa nirodha idang nirujhati. So notice what's going on here. It's an observation. It once again, sticking close to the simple and observable facts of our experience, right? And notice that when we start to talk about things like interdependence and dependent origination and so on, it's very easy to spin off into abstract abstractions and ideas and theories about it. Yeah. Whereas what the Buddha was starting out by pointing us to our experience and say, look at what's happening in that experience and look at that pattern of what's happening. Yeah. Start with things that are very simple and clearly observable. I see that pleasant feeling arising. What happens? Yeah? Right? Mind thinks of ice cream. I just said the word ice cream. What happened in your mind? Well, we got an instant reaction over here. I'd hardly even got the word cream out. And we already had one. patterns. Yeah. Ah, this happens and that happens. This happens and that happens. Ah, and then you keep following that through. Ah, now that I've mentioned the word ice cream, you're sitting there thinking, wow, maybe when's the class going to be finished? And then you go and eat the ice cream and then you feel guilty and you think, oh, now I have to go and work out to kind of... You feel good afterwards, do you? Yeah. Set up some kind of what, sorry? Is it? Well, of course. Obviously, I didn't need science to tell me that. So it's observing the patterns, yeah, the arising of things, the ceasing of things. And, of course, by watching this again and again and again, and we learn obviously not to get attached to things, you learn to see things as they are, you're not disturbed when things are absent, you're not upset or holding on to them when they appear, and when they pass away, you understand this is just how nature works. Now, the full 12 factors of dependent origination is going to be, unfortunately, too much even for me to attempt in the next 3 minutes. So I'll spare you from that for the time being. But you can see that this principle underlies and informs all of the other wisdom teachings. Yeah? So all the things like the five aggregates, impermanence, the senses, the elements, and all of these kinds of things. These are all conditioned. Everything we're experiencing is conditioned. And because it's conditioned, it's comprehensible. Ah, this is important. Pay attention to this. Because it's conditioned, it is comprehensible. Right? Because it follows patterns. Yeah? Things that follow patterns are comprehensible. So you observe and you keep on observing. Ah, watching those patterns again and again and again. You know, you think about how great scientists work. Right? Someone like Charles Darwin, how did he work? Did he sit in a room and imagine this is how life must have happened? Of course not. He went out into nature, went to the Galapagos Islands and places like this and observed. Ah, this is what happens. This is what that kind of birds are. This is that finch's shaped beak is like this and it's eating that kind of food. And this bird has this kind of shaped beak and it's eating that kind of food. And it's observing the relationships. And you observe this again and again and again and again. And gradually you can start to infer the principles and understand what's happening on behind that. So when it comes to dependent origination, don't get distracted by all the complexities and the detail and so on. Remember, as with everything I've been talking about today, we start with the simple, plain, observable realities. We stay close to our experience. We spend a lot of time with our experience. You value it. You care about it. Huh? Pay attention to it. It's important. Every breath that you take is important. Every feeling you take is important. Pay attention to it. Your whole life happens in the present. Right? It never happens in the past and the future. If you can't learn to pay attention to your present, you will not learn to pay attention to your life. Right? Your life is nothing more than this present as it unfolds. So we learn to pay attention to that, watch it as it unfolds and understand. You learn to discern and recognize these patterns, become familiar with it. These are the patterns of our life. And remember, as I was saying before, that wisdom leads to peace. Yeah? And so we don't... study Buddhism in order to... I always thought it's funny in some places they have like courses in Buddhism and tests and things like that. I can beat you at Buddhism. I always think it's a funny idea, don't you? I can do a dumber exam and I can get a better mark. In Thailand they had a bit of a scandal when the monks were doing a dumber exam in one place and they were cheating. But the scandal was that the lecturer who was supposed, there was another monk who was supposed to be teaching them, he was giving them the answers. Right? all crazy. So we don't learn Dhamma to beat somebody else at the Dhamma exams, yeah? You learn Dhamma to find peace. Well, wisdom is to find peace. And that's the ultimate criterion. Okay, so we've been sitting for quite a while now, so let's have a bit of a break. It's now 2 o'clock. 2:30. We'll have a break for a cup of tea and so on. We'll come back at 3 o'clock for the discussion sessions. And as I've said all along, the discussion's an intrinsic part of what we're doing. We have to learn to listen to others and to articulate in order to make sense and to deepen our wisdom. So we'll see you all back here at 3 o'clock.